Hello, young lovers, whoever you are. I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Reed Lance Rosenthal with us, the author of Threads West, An American Saga, Book 1, Maps of Fate, Book 2, in the American Saga series. He's in. He's got the. Is the winner of 7 national awards. Is the number one best-selling debut novel. And again, from author Rancher Reed Lance Rosenthal, the first book of an 8-novel series that reminds us of the American spirit through a tale of romance, adventure, and Western history. Reed, I welcome to the show.
My pleasure to be on, Michael. How are you?
Oh, I am good, and thank you so much for being here. You know, when we talk about an American saga, you know, we need books like you've got, because for some reason, Reed, we seem to be forgetting who we are. And the Tales of the West really puts it together, because that's really where we started. It was that kind of a world, and that's, where we came from. And for some reason, in the schools and everything else, it's starting to get diluted, and we're losing that.
You know, that's exactly right, Michael. I write because I want to write, but this is a story which has been bouncing around in my head for 30 years, and I have to tell you that, you know, it's about romance. It's about the universal energies of romance and the land and the West and the American spirit. And there's a message in this book, and the message in this book is a return to frontier values, you know. There's traits, I think, that can restore America. It's our touchstone, and I think if we're going to be moving forward in the type of America that we've come to know and to love, then I think we have to reach back for that touchstone of courage and self-reliance, and that's what this book is about.
Sure, and when you go back to it, we go all the way back, we take a look at, you know, mom and dad. You know, dad would teach the son to ride and shoot and hunt, and mom would teach the girls to cook and so on and so forth. Well, and then we had the little schoolhouse, maybe 8-10 kids in it, whatever. And then the railroad got invented, and then they went farther out, and then they got even farther out, and then mom and dad and that kind of a life lost it, because in those days, mom and dad were the be-all, end-all. They were the teachers. Now, mom and dad don't teach you how to drive. You have to go to driving school, you know, and the government tells you what to do and where to go. So there was somewhere along the way that we totally and completely got lost. And in that being lost, a dilution of what an American is happened also.
I happen to agree 100%. The series starts in 1855. It's the uncommon threads of disparate lives that come from different social origins, in fact, originate in Europe, and how they kind of wind together into the tapestry of an emerging nation. But the last book, the 8th book, when she's written, boy, it's a hell, it's a project, I will tell you. But I love it. The 8th book is in the real time of the contemporary West. So this is really, it's our story, you know. It is the story of us. And everything you say is true, and I'm just starting book 3, and book 2 is ready to be released here in the next 60 plus or minus days. And, you know, as I get more and more into the history of it, I can kind of see how we've lost our way, how we've kind of made things easy for ourselves, we thought, by shoveling off responsibilities to others. You know, the responsibilities, as you mentioned, of educating our kids, we've shoveled off to the school. And the school is run by the government. And the government is, shall we say, it's not our friend. You know, the government is there to take our rights, and we've allowed this to happen over time. It's one of the reasons, I think, that we need to go back to what made us great 234 years ago and to the crucible of where the American spirit was really forged, which I think is the West, the United States, and the great Western migration of the 1850s and 1860s.
Sure. When you talk about government not being our friend, we moved away from Western Europe. And what's going on right now is we're becoming what Europe is today. The transition is very interesting to see what's occurring. And if somebody doesn't wake up pretty soon, who we are and who we've been is not going to be here within the next, I think, 15 or 20 years. So realistically, we've got to have those markers, those little bit of those indicators that say, don't forget who you are. Don't forget how you navigate through life has to do with what you were taught an American is. And they're not teaching that anymore, because I sometimes read, I take a look at what's going on in the schools and get absolutely shocked to see what's being taught.
Oh, it's appalling. You know, my kids went to school in a very small school, 87 kids in the high school. And because it's so small, you knew the teachers, you knew what was being taught. But, you know, even there, the overburdening hand of government and federal mandates was apparent, although thankfully mostly ignored. And I will tell you that when you sit back and look at Europe, to go with that point of yours, which is excellent, you know, Europe is a disaster, and it's probably going to dissolve, and it's going to have, I think, material adverse effects on America. However, there is a silver lining to that cloud, because we have a very clear picture of where we will be if we don't mend our ways and get back to the past. It's kind of, you know, a back to the future, back to the past type of syndrome.
Yeah, but we have to really take a look at it, and I think that's where the concern is right now. There's so much, and I don't want to get off subject here, but there's so much media that is going on that is getting people confused out there. It's just a myriad of what everybody's hearing. Five or six different ways a story is told. You never hear the truth about anything anymore. Prime example, and I don't want to get political, but a prime example of where the confusion is coming from. Mitt Romney, he was talking about he wanted to have his choice of insurance companies, his choice of businesses, and he wants to be able to say who he works for, and if he wants to fire somebody, fire somebody. He's talking about businesses. He's talking about capitalism. He's talking about the way this country was set up in the first place. You don't like doing business with somebody, don't do it. That's not what the government's saying, and look what they've done to it. So the real messages today have to be impactful, and they have to be repetitive and over and over and over again until somebody finally gets it.
Well, that's really true, and you have to be aware that, you know, your whatever sounds you make will be taken in bites that best suits whoever is relaying it on to whatever audience they choose. And, you know, to take Mitt Romney's example, you know, to say, I like to fire people, and to take that one sentence out of it was a two-paragraph statement having to do with insurance companies, as you said, you know, is outrageous. But, you know, I think you're dealing with ideologues, even though they're a small percentage of American society. We've been asleep at the switch. We've allowed them to kind of intrude upon our lives. And now they have a lot of power. And it's going to take some pain, and it's going to take some work to get this ship of state turned around. But I think it starts with the individual. I think it starts with self-reliance. I think it starts in being secure in your convictions and proud of your beliefs and standing up for them. And I think it starts in your community. It's neighbor to neighbor, community standing together. And, you know, that really is the West. That is the West when the Great Migration occurred in the 1800s. And it's a set of values that I think carried through all the way through World War II until they started to dissipate. And we allowed them to dissipate. It's really our fault.
No question about it. When it comes down to it, Reed, it's your fault, it's my fault, it's everybody who has a piece or a part of this country, because somebody didn't stand up. Somebody got to a point of saying, what are you going to give me? And if you give me enough, I'm on your side. And we caved in.
Oh, that's exactly right. I mean, listen, our tax dollars are buying their votes. I mean, it's the antithesis of self-reliance.
No, absolutely no question about it. And that's not the way it went in the West. Now, obviously, we were in a situation way back in the 1800s whereby you had the Pony Express. If you mailed somebody something, they might not get it for a month or so, if they even got it. And you had a lot of quote-unquote uneducated people. But most of those people knew what they were about. They got up in the morning. They knew what they had to do to survive for the day. They went to sleep with their families, and they were living a decent life. It wasn't muddled in all of this confusion and fear of if they say something, somebody's going to come and get them.
And listen, also, Michael, you know, they had values, and they were willing to fight for them, and they were willing to live by them. You know, I think, unfortunately, that those values have been eroded, and in some cases, cast aside by many. And those are the values we have to return to. Turning around America starts with each one of us individually.
Let me give you a simple value, okay? I was brought up basically as a teenager in the 50s. Now, my mom was 5 foot tall, and if she opened the mouth, I shut up, and so did my brothers and sister. But there was family value. The kids today, I can't imagine using a four-letter expletive to my mom. The back of my neck still gets the hair crinkles up if I think about it. But that's value. We have lost the family value. What the agrarian society had, the farmers, etc., they had value. They had family, and they depended upon each other. It doesn't work that way today. Family is not family as we knew it, as we grew up with it. And family was the very base, the source of what America is about.
Absolutely. Family is the key unit, which I think constitutes the community. And the individual is the key unit of the family. And that's our basic building block. You know, the good news in all.
Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Wright. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
In a trance, you fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say, don't cry because I'm alone.
Jeffrey Haislett with us. He's the author of Running the Gauntlet, Essential Business Lessons to Lead, to Drive Change, and to Grow Profits. He's a best-selling author, a global business celebrity, and a sometimes cowboy. He's as comfortable in the boardroom as he is in the barn. His get your hands dirty approach means he's not afraid to say whatever it takes to drive change and get the point home. His grassroots approach to changing business is complemented by his cowboy style. Literally, he wears cowboy boots 24/7 and isn't afraid to use them to figuratively kick some sense into the toughest and most change-resistant audiences. You've seen him as judge on Celebrity Apprentice, offering his business and marketing insight on shows like MSNBC's Your Business and Fox and Friends. And let us say, Jeffrey, hey, welcome to the show.
Well, it's good to be here, and thanks for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, one of the things that I've seen in business, and I know this is something that you address, but I want to say it just a little bit different, because you talk about, you know, the forgetting the fear, the apathy, the rest of it. We live in a very much of a blame-based society right now. You know, I'm not happy because of you. I'm not successful because of you. I wet my bed because of you. And the key here is we do nothing but point fingers. And is that what goes on in business today?
Oh, it happens all the time. But, you know, usually the one you're pointing at, you should go look in the mirror, because that's the one responsible for the most part. You know, in business, I just believe you should just look at yourself, and that's why I wrote Running the Gauntlet. You know, my first book was called The Mirror Test. This one, Running the Gauntlet, just hit the bestseller list as well. But, you know, people need to take responsibility for business. In fact, in business right now, we've done such a great job at cutting our way to prosperity, or trying to. And we've gotten great at being able to eliminate jobs. We can outsource everything. It's about time we started growing our businesses rather than cutting our way.
Now, by the way, we usually have been taught to, quote-unquote, take the lead. Like him, dislike him, I don't want to get political. But Romney, for instance, the popularity that he has garnered over the last couple of weeks, month, whatever, it's skyrocketing. But at the same time, the very thing that conservatives, and I happen to be a Republican, that conservatives are talking about the free market society, talking about, you know, capitalism is the way that we should be, get out there and make your own and do whatever. It's the very thing that this man did that stands for everything this country was rooted with is what's causing him to fail right now. It's a very interesting message that's going on out there today.
Well, he's going to have a tough job, I think, in November against Obama with that, because of that record, because of some of the tactics, some of his, you know, Bain and some of the companies he's been involved with has done. You know, I think most of us would always, I think most people in America would rather, you know, go with a candidate or even a company that's building things rather than tearing things down. So he'll just need to show his record and show people that he was an agent of change. He was a person who could build businesses. And by the way, you know, some of them are going to fail and some of them are going to go. That's the nature of business. You know, get over it. No one died. And in the end, he'll be judged on his record, which is what he should be.
You know, by the way, you said something I think it's extremely important. I was brought up with that tactic, you know, effectively, get over it, move through it.
Exactly. I mean, in fact, I devoted a whole couple of chapters to, you know, take risk. I mean, that's what, you know, running the gauntlet's about is taking risk, and business is about risk, calculated risk as much as possible. But if you make a mistake, come on, get over it. No one's going to die outside of being a brain surgeon or operating heavy equipment. I mean, most of us in business, small business, you're a dry cleaner, you're running, you're cutting hair, just don't run with scissors. But, you know, you're not going to die. So get on with it.
Yeah, and it's risk, reward, incentive. That's what we were brought up on. And I really believe that if anybody truly wants that today, they're going to have to grit their teeth, quote unquote, you said it, get over it, and move through and create what was once what once was the impetus for us being who we are. We were built on, you can be all you want to be. If you want to be it, go out and do it, instead of saying, well, you're making money, you're really not the nicest guy in the world now.
Well, we should be rewarding the people that make money, because they're the ones that make the jobs happen, and we want to do that. I happen to be on the other end of the political spectrum, but it doesn't make a difference. I still believe profit's a good word. And I think we should be driving profits in our business, because that's how we reinvest and get more people more jobs and pay people, you know, a fair wage. And I think that's what we should be concentrating on. Again, getting back to the basics, look at conditions of satisfaction in your business and drive change, not change for change's sake, because nobody wants to do that. But if you're taking a trip down the road, you don't lock in your steering wheel. You're going to make adjustments. You're going to make detours. It's about putting a business plan in place and then driving through to your success.
No, absolutely, no question about it. And when you really come down to it, it doesn't really matter what end of the political spectrum that you're on. The key is it's okay to go out and make money. It's okay to have a business. It's okay to make as much as you possibly want to make, as long as it's not at the expense of another, quote unquote. We know what that is. You're talking integrity, etc. But the point of contention is why not let somebody who has the ability, who has the wherewithal and the know-how and the guts, go out and make everything that it can possibly make. I'm totally behind you on this. It's called...
And by the way, don't tax them to death either. I mean, no. I remember one time having a conversation with somebody, and they said, well, we should tax all those fat cats. I said, what are you talking about, fat cats? You're looking at one. You mean, why should I have to pay more? So I don't mind paying my fair share, and nobody should. But let's be fair about it. But more importantly, let's drive a system that's going to reward those people who are making it happen and confront those people that aren't.
Well, when you really come down to it, that's really what it's about. It's called reward. And where it should start is not necessarily in business. Where it's got to start, Jeff, is got to start in the schools. They've got to be taught that. They're not being taught that now. You talk about friend sourcing. Jeff Howe of Wired Magazine, you know, he and Mark Robinson called that phenomenon of crowdsourcing, you know, the way to go with this, and it became a word of choice, a term of choice, and people used it. Now, it seems as though you've got that one step above it now, which is the friend sourcing.
Well, I outline that in my book about friend sourcing and how we use our friends to source ideas, to source opinions, and to help us get to places that we want to go. I mean, you watch a woman who goes into the store. She used to go with her friends to the store, and she would come out and say, hey, how do I look in this dress? And they would tell her, well, today with social media, new techniques, she'll take a picture of herself and send it and post it and ask those friends. This stuff's been around forever. It's just a matter of tapping into these new tools that are available to us and utilizing them to drive the profits and drive the revenues that we need to have in our business.
And there's an old adage, and that old adage is better be unhappy than unsure. As we age, is it tougher for people to get out there and make those change decisions?
I think it's tough for anyone, whether you're young or old, fat or skinny. Good looking or not so good looking. I think it's tough for people because we are people. But it's all about fear for the most part. We're afraid to be beginners. And I tell people you can't be afraid to be a beginner. I don't know what I don't know. And I'm comfortable with that. And so, but I constantly want to be a beginner because that means I'm going to learn some really cool and new stuff. So get over your fear, because I know that, you know, when I first learned to ride a horse, I was pretty scared. But after that first couple seconds, man, what a great time. And that's what it needs to be in your business as well.
Now, by the way, I'm an old horseman, and I haven't owned a horse probably for close to 10 years now. But there was a horse that I had that it got cinch bound. You'd cinch it up, and it would go up over and backward. And I got a fear in me that would not quit. And, you know, I'd saddle him up, I'd get on him, but the horse knew that there was some fear in me. And I had a trainer that lived about a half mile away, and I used to ride him over there, and he'd put us in the round pen. And what she would have me do was chase the horse, get the horse moving, get me moving. And I'll tell you what, I got so involved in what I was doing and so out of breath and so physically active.
You forgot.
Yes, the fear went.
Exactly. Well, and horses have that instinctive ability to know that, you know, if you're irritated, they become irritated and so forth. So they transfer that, just like employees do. It's like mood. And mood's important in business. In fact, I tell this in Running the Gauntlet, that you've got to change the mood in the business, because if you have a bad mood, it's going to permeate throughout the entire organization, just like with you and that horse. If you have a bad thing, that fear, it's contagious. And
sure,
You've got to fix that in order to run a good business.
Oh, absolutely. No question. And I really believe something else very important in business and presentation and communication, whatever it is, it's called don't go in accidental, go in intentional. Know exactly what you want out of what you're going to put your time into. You know, when do you say audience, one person, 10 million, a customer, client, whatever. It's what do you want them to know? What do you want them to feel? What do you want them to do? What's the compelling reason to buy? What are they going to lose if they don't take action? And if you walk in with those four things, no matter where you are, your intentions are not accidental. You get what you want. And I'll tie that right into the 10 questions that you have to ask before you launch a project.
Right, exactly. Well, and it gets back to one of my original concepts in the book around conditions of satisfaction, and that's knowing what promises you're supposed to be driving. By knowing those things and by putting them through the filters of the 10 questions or ways in which you'd ask those questions, you get concentrated, meaning you get focused in on just driving the things that are most important in your business. And that's how you survive running the gauntlet.
Yeah. Now, by the way, confidence is something that most people, they have to learn. It's not something that comes innate. Confidence.
Or you can fake it. There's nothing wrong with faking it every once in a while, too.
Yeah, who was it? It was Sun Tzu, you know, the art of being a warrior. You know, if you're strong, let your enemy think you're weak, and if you're weak, let him think you're strong. And,
exactly.
And obviously,
exactly.
You're there. Yeah. But what is confidence when it really comes down to it? And the confidence has to be within yourself. Not that you can do the project, you can't do the project, knowing that you'll know what to do when it's time to do it.
Or know the people that you need to be able to bring in to get it done for you. And
yeah.
So it's that process of being able to go through it. And again, sometimes you're not always going to know, but maybe know some folks or know some people that you can call on for help, or know that you're out of your depth. And that's okay. There's a confidence in knowing that. I mean, if I'm a quarterback in a football team, I'd much rather have my players walk back and tell me, Jeff, I can't block that guy. He's bigger than me. I don't have the ability. I have the confidence in myself to know that I can't get it done. Can someone help me? I'd much rather do that than knowing that he lies about it or doesn't do anything, and I get sacked in the process.
Yeah, and two things here. One is, there's an old adage that I've lived by for many, many years now, Jeff. A good leader knows when to follow, and a good teacher knows when to be a student. And I change hats constantly, constantly, constantly. And the key to that is this. I have the magic, and I'm sure you have the same magic. And if anybody who's got their wherewithal of what they do has this very special thing, it's called a Rolodex.
Exactly. I have 9,000 in my personal and then in my professional one, we've got about 100,000. So exactly right. Being able to tap into those friends. Again, friend sourcing.
Yeah. Yeah, I like it. And one of the things that you said, which I really love, if being a jerk works, why change it?
Exactly. Not that I advocate everybody being a jerk, but I'm advocating that, you know, hold people's feet to the fire, make sure they're delivering on the things that they're supposed to be delivering. And sometimes, you know, being a boss isn't all that pleasant.
Yeah, and absolutely. And one of the things I've learned for years, communication has a lot to do with it. I've done counseling on and off and consulting on and off for many, many years. And what I would do, and I mentioned this on the air before, I walk in, I'll talk to the CEO, CFO, COO, whomever, and sit down and say, okay, the person directly under you, write down what they're supposed to do. And they'll write it down and they'll do, you know, all the work on it and clean it up. And then I'll go to that person and say, okay, write down what you're supposed to do. What's your job here? And they'll write it down. Jeff, 9 out of 10 times when you match them up, they're not the same.
Two different things. Again, I can't, you know, that's why in Running the Gauntlet, I spend so much time talking about getting alignment around that conditions of satisfaction. By knowing who's the customer and who's the performer and what promises are you driving. And I'm really talking about promises. These aren't goals. These are things that you have to deliver. I mean, if you've ever had talked to your children, they said, well, you promised to take me to Disney World. And that word promise, you know, you didn't suggest that you take me to Disney World. You promised. And we all know what that means. And so that's what businesses need to get back to, is holding people's feet to the fire around the things that we're supposed to be delivering, the outcomes that we're supposed to drive, and then the way in which we drive those, and then make sure they get done.
No question about it. Now, okay, I picked the book up. And by the way, I've got the book in front of me. I read it page by page, cover to cover. Jeff, what's my takeaway? What do I, Michael Ray, get that I did not have before that I read this book?
There's so many. I tell you, there's one other thing in that book that nobody knows about. Well, they're starting to know about it as it's come out and being bestseller, and that's snap tags. In the front of every single chapter, I put a snap tag. You take a picture, you text it. When you text it, a video comes back of me telling you what we're going to share in that chapter. So we have an intimate conversation that just pops off. So we have video popping off that written page in a way in which you can interact with me in a different way, and that's a pretty exciting thing for a book like this.
I'm going to use a word that this word has stayed constant over decades and decades and decades, and this word, for some reason, always gets the point across. One word for what you just said, cool.
Well, thank you. It's a new concept, and a lot of people haven't used it, but we've decided to update the book and do something a little different. I've been known as the kind of the chief marketing officer on steroids, a celebrity CMO, and so we decided to do something a little bit different with the book, and so we're expanding publishing into video.
Cool. Okay, and by the way, Jeff, that's great. We're just about out of time. Let me ask you this. Do you have a website we can find you, buy the book, and find out more?
Absolutely. You can go to hazlett.com, H-A-Y-Z-L-E-T-T.com. You can find me on Twitter at Jeffrey Hazlett. You can find me at my website. You can find me on LinkedIn. You can find me on Facebook and our fan site there. You can get the book at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and certainly at your independent bookstore.
Wonderful. Hey, Jeff, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases, pleasant as home is, cities and what Rome is, so why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris. Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star, brave and faithful and true.
David Dreeman with us. He's the author of Contrarian Investment Strategies, The Psychological Edge. He's the chairman and managing director of Dreeman Value Management, a firm that pioneered contrarian strategies on the street and manages over $5 billion of individual and institutional funds. Regarded as the Dean of Contrarians, he's the author of the critically acclaimed Psychology and the Stock Market and Contrarian Investment Strategies. Dreamon is also the senior investment columnist at Forbes magazine. Articles about the success of his methods have appeared in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Fortune, Barron's, and the list goes on. Let's say, David, I welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much, Michael.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. David, when we take a look at investment and the stock market today and the economy, which we're really not too sure of, what is that something, what is that overarching theme that you've found that there can be at least a modicum of safety to keep people comfortable when they do invest?
Well, I think the in today's market, investors are very anxious, and I think they very justifiably should be. The one thing that gives me some comfort, and I think a lot of professional investors, is that we're through the worst of it. 2008 was like almost sailing off the edge of the world.
Sure.
And now we're coming back, and there's no question the economy is, particularly unemployment, is coming back much more slowly than we would have wanted. But
sure.
We're not turning down again, and we seem to be making, since of around April or May, we've been making some progress. And secondly, I think the stock market is really very cheap. It's probably, when you look at, say, the measures like price-earnings ratio or other valuations, it's as cheap as it's been in almost 20 years. On next year's earnings, the S&P is trading about 13 times, 14 times earnings, which is really very, very low. And companies have major amounts of cash, which they didn't have in 2008. So they've built up a tremendous cash reserve, and they're conservative. They're not expanding quickly. They want to make sure that the economy, they're not ahead of the economy, but they have enormous cash, and corporate America is in pretty good shape.
David, let me tell you what I'm looking at, which I think is phenomenally interesting with what you've done here. I've got your press material in front of me, the releases. And from what I'm saying is investment today in and of itself is almost a behavior. It's taking on its own form, its own culture, and every behavior has a has an attitude. It has a it has an impetus behind it, and there's a reason why it does what it does. And if you talk about cognitive psychology, we're looking at the stock market as a behavior, almost as an entity unto itself with a behavior. And if we understand the behavior, we can work through all the challenges that we're faced with.
Yes, I think that's really what the book emphasizes, and there. This is fairly new work. I'd written a book roughly in 1997, and much of this work was had not even been done. So the the psychological researchers have actually found is that we can be so excited by the prospects of a stock as if we were back in the dot-com bubble, we can overvalue it by 100 or even sometimes several hundred or as much as 1,000 or more times its real worth. And likewise, if we don't like a company or we think there are very bad times ahead, we can undervalue really first-rate companies by almost 80, 90%. And we're in one of those markets where we have a very high volatility for a number of reasons, particularly the high, what they call high-frequency trading. We're seeing investors like stability when they buy stocks. They don't want stocks to be down 40, 50% in a day, which happened in the flash crash in 2010. And so the higher high-frequency trading and the higher volatility has frightened a lot of people out of the market. And I guess one of the important parts of this is that the investor can ride through this. It's harder than it was because of this enormous volatility. But the high-frequency traders and others who are, I think, are disruptive to the market aren't really taking positions. They're taking positions for the moment. If a market's going down, they'll short it and really accentuate the drive down. And likewise, if a market moves up, they'll move up and carry it higher than it would normally go. But if we know that they're not there for long, we can take we can find opportunities when they drive markets down and really take advantage of this behavior. It's tough to do because psychologically, when companies drop 10, 15, 20% or more, and we've seen them drop as much as the flash crashes over 60%, it's terrifying. But there are ways to get around this kind of fear, and that is what the book attempts to explain.
But isn't it also understanding it? You know, the new work in neuropsychology that you discuss in Chapter 12, the surprises, et cetera. Well, and then stop me if I'm wrong here. Let me give you what I'm hearing. And looking at neurosciences, if somebody approaches me with something just I think is phenomenal, I want to get a shot of dopamine. I'm going to feel some good something about it, and I'm going to invest. That doesn't mean that stock is good, bad, or indifferent. It means that if I don't understand my own psychology and tie it to the psychology and the behavior of the stock market, I'm going to be in major trouble. So are we looking to hook up the two and balance here?
Yeah, Michael, that's exactly right. Actually, there's some mention that when markets move up, the reaction on many investors is like a shot of dopamine or something, some pretty strong drug. They really tend to overreact. They get very, very excited and they take it much higher than they should. And likewise, if the results are negative, they'll take a much lower stocks, much lower than they should. And what we've seen is that when we look at earnings surprises, it really seems to fit in very well with neuropsychology because with favorite stocks, for example, if they get a positive surprise, they don't do all that well. There's too much expectation built into it. They'll go up a little bit, not a lot. However, if I like a stock that's a real favorite today, and it gets a negative surprise, not talking about any one stock, but just the average of all these surprises, if they get a negative surprise, they tend to go down very sharply as a group.
Yeah, no question. I want to touch on something which I think is – I want to step ahead just for a moment. One of your talking points I think is critically important to address, and especially how it's going to affect the stock market with what's going on politically right now. It doesn't matter, you know, left, right, indifferent. That's not where I'm at with it. But the problem of the chronic unemployment and what we've seen, the jobs, you know, go to different countries, go to China, wherever the case may be, the outsourcing and the rest of it. And based on who – comes into office, if Obama gets out of office, you're going to have a completely new look at how things should be run in the country. I would venture to guess if I was in the stock market, I mean, on the other side of it, if I was heavily involved, I would be very concerned right now about where I wanted to put money because I don't know what this outcome is going to be in the next 10, 11 months or so. Because if we take it back from China and we create our own manufacturing, if we do what we've always done to be who we are, now, all of a sudden, we're going to have a lot of people employed that weren't employed. Unemployment right now is they're going for 90 weeks. I know people on unemployment that are getting $500 a week. That's $2,000 a month. Why would somebody want to work? So this entire psychology of being employed and how we run the country is going to drastically affect the stock market and how people put money into it and where they put money.
Yes, I think you're right on the mark on that. The basically, we have major balance of trade deficits, and that's why they've extended unemployment benefits, and this is only a temporary extension.
Sure.
But just to get the country back on its feet, because over the last decade, we've lost to China alone, directly and indirectly, almost 2 million jobs, and what they call the Asian tigers, Taiwan and Malaysia and many of the others, have gained another 500,000. So we really lost almost 2.5 million jobs, maybe more than that. And we are a free trader, but we Ricardo was the economist that was in favor, came out with the free trade theories back in the early 19th century, and Adam Smith. They said you could only be a free trader with free traders. And
sure.
So we have to have more pressure on the Chinese to trade fairly. What they, and not only the Chinese, but a lot of the developing countries pretty much shut us out of their markets, and they take our proprietary rights. Like Microsoft, for example, only sells 20% of all the software for computers in China. The rest is made in China, and it is just duplicated from Microsoft without paying any royalties. And if we looked at this across, say, just China alone, and I don't mean to scapegoat China, but they probably there's more information on it than any of the other countries. If we looked at what the Chinese kind of say. Take from us, or I mean, borrow from us. Our balance of trade with China is probably about a $250 billion a year deficit. If they paid for the things that other countries pay for, we would actually have a trade surplus with China.
No, absolutely. And for some reason, David and I'm going to say I don't know why, but if we take a look at it, you know, strategically, we've seen what's happened politically over the last 3-4 years, that we're in a position now that we have backed off of everything. You know, we're frightened to death of getting the pipeline to, you know, from Canada, because it might be some kind of an environmental problem somewhere. We don't want to drill for oil, so we give somebody, you know, another country billions of dollars to do so. So what we've literally done is we've given it away, we've taken it away from ourselves, and we put ourselves in a situation where more and more people today are getting dependent upon government. And I really believe that in and of itself has a tremendous effect, an impact on the stock market.
Yes, I think that's absolutely true. And for example, I think a clear case of this is the idea that we've actually, as a nation, we're almost totally self-sufficient in natural resources, other than say oil. But we've more than doubled our natural gas resources in the last findings in the last 10 years. And if we started to convert, use natural gas, as Boone Pickens and others have suggested, we could save something if our 18-wheelers would use natural gas, and some of our other large trucks and so forth. We would actually, just in transportation alone, save 2 million barrels of oil a day. So we certainly have the means of doing it, but the politicians up to this point haven't done it.
No.
Or really even pushed for it.
And I really believe if you go back to the old standard, if you want to know where the problems are, you follow the money wherever that's going to lead you. Because if you go back, administrations come and go, parties come and go that are running the country, etc. But the only thing that really stays constant is business, and business knows what its focus is. Its focus is on money. And I think that's where the problem is, because if you take a look at some of the problems we've had, Republican, Democrat, independent, really doesn't matter. If you look at some of the problems, especially in the investment portfolios, it's gone over not 3 years, it's gone over 10, 15, 20 years, and it's the different administrations, the different psychology, the different attitudes that they have, and yet some of the same problems exist. So I would say some of the problems are intrinsic, they're inherent. within the culture and the society and the way we do things, no matter who's in charge. So some of that has got to change, but we need to take a look at it and just, you know, kind of quote unquote suck it up and be responsible and move forward.
I think that's also something I agree with, because the subprime was not the caused by the Democrats alone, nor the Republicans alone. Both parties contributed in a major way to lowering our standards and having that crisis. And I think the same problem is there with oil and gas. As you said, it didn't matter whether it was a Republican or a Democratic administration. Both really have not taken strong enough action in, say, developing natural gas, which is a major resource for the United States. And we could actually be a net exporter of energy if we did this. And it's not impossible to do. In fact, it's quite easy to do if companies are given accelerated depreciation on converting trucks, for example. I think really very quickly lower our dependence on oil. Within, you know, within 3-4 years, I think our dependence could drop pretty significantly.
Let me interrupt you just for a second. We're starting to run out of time, but there's a very important thought here. Is that this, with the electric cars, obviously they save a tremendous amount of gas and so on and so forth, but you're going to pay $80,000-$90,000 for the car. And I think that's one of the things that we haven't looked at. You've got proponents, activists that say, do this, do this, and do that. But what's the cost of the savings? And I ask that rhetorically.
Well, that's a very interesting question, because it happened to us during the, I think we had an oil embargo, was it back in 1968, another one back in the 70s, and people would pay up for cars that ran on diesel, and diesel was cheaper than gasoline at the time, but it didn't take very long, and so people would pay up in the thousands of dollars to get diesel driven cars, but lo and behold, once they started doing this, the price of diesel oil, fuel oil, went up as high or higher than gasoline in some places. So that wasn't a real answer. Whereas I think the answer of really using the natural resources we have is natural gas and encouraging their use is a much better one. Green is a very good idea in principle, but it's not cost effective at this point in time.
No, and absolutely. David, I could talk to you all night about this. We're starting to run out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at, buy the book, and get more information?
Yes, the book would probably be in...
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call. And the only heart I own for you and you alone, that's all, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall. And a love whose burning light will warm the winter night, that's all. That's all.
Erin Botsford with us. She's the author of The Big Retirement Risk, Running Out of Money Before You Run Out of Time. She's the founder and CEO of Botsford Group, a boutique financial planning firm that specializes in retirement investment planning and asset protection. And among the top echelon of financial advisors, Erin's nationally renowned for being a thought leader in the 21st century, investing, risk management, and retirement. She specializes in all of it. She's authored, again, The Retirement Risk, to teach people how to prepare and craft an investment strategy, very important word, to help protect any retirement lifestyle. And let us say, Erin and I, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Oh, and thank you for being here. You know, retirement, especially today with everything that's going on in the economy and the confusion that most people are up against, I think the most important word in your bio was strategy. Most people get emotional and they want to, you know, get rich quick. They went out and throw money into something, and the next thing you know, they're in trouble and they've lost it. So realistically, control your emotions and have a strategy seems to be the way to go.
Well, I would have to agree with you. And the reason I wrote the book is we had figured out that in 2008, our strategy actually worked. And so I felt like there was a lot of lost confidence among especially pre-retirees and those who had already retired, because a lot of people had lost a lot of money, and whatever strategy they were working had not worked. And so, you know, we have a small boutique firm with about 450 retired clients, and they didn't have to change their lifestyle. I thought, you know, maybe it's time to spread this word to a broader audience. So that's what the Big Retirement Risk is all about.
Oh, absolutely. And I think when you really come down to it, the biggest problem that most people would have, and it's in the tagline, running out of money before you run out of time. Let's pick a number. Let's say somebody, it's cost them $5,000 a month to live today on average. And they're getting $5,000-$6,000 a month on their retirement. But that doesn't mean that in 15 years from now, 10, 15 years from now, that same $5,000 that it cost them to live, that they're still getting five, it may cost them $8,000, $10,000, $12,000, $15,000 to live. So it's also keeping up with whatever the value of money is at the time.
That's right, an inflation factor.
But how do you deal with that? How do you forecast something like that?
Well,
as part of this?
First of all, you can build in certain models and certain forecasts. And, you know, in a perfect world, if you have plenty of money, there's a lot that you can do. But a lot of people right now are just sort of reeling from what happened before. And if they could just get that $5,000 a month that they had planned for, they'd be really happy with that. So what we really do, it's written in the book, is we build what we call people's house of security. And I think that's what I outline in Chapter 5, and I think that's a really good place to start for people. And what you want to do in a house of security, every house forms a foundation. You need a foundation. And what our foundation is our needs. And I think what people haven't done is they really haven't broken down what exactly does it take to live and what are my real needs. I mean, is really a manicure and a pedicure every month, is that a need? You know, some people would think so, but let's take it down. And my book says let's take it down really to the basics. And a need is food and shelter, for instance. And so we try and break it down and say, at a very minimum, I need X amount for my food and shelter. And maybe there's some other things. You certainly need health insurance, maybe long-term care insurance and things like that. We call those non-negotiable items. And what we try and do is we invest specifically to make sure that the money comes in to pay that no matter what. And so we fund those with what we call lifestyle investments. And what I've done successfully over the years is I've created a criteria by which you can filter all your investment choices. And so, for instance, a lifestyle investment is going to be used to provide for one of these non-negotiable needs. And so what does it have to do? Well, one, it has to produce an income, for sure. And we want that income to have some word like safe, predictable, guaranteed. And so we filter all of our investment choices through the filter. Does it meet that criteria? If yes, you consider it and you put it in and you fund your needs with that. Then you go up the hierarchical structure. Okay, what are your wants? Now, is you know, a lot of times dining out three times a week, that's a want. That's certainly not a need. And you can fund your wants and the monthly income that you need for those items in a slightly different way than you do your needs. So I think what we need to do as a nation, as a culture, we kind of need to press reset. And we need to go back to the basics and say, what are we trying to do? What we tend to do is we say, oh, we need $5,000 a month or we need $10,000 a month. Well, really? Is that really what you need? And so what we try and do is we sort of jury-rig a system. We throw a bunch of money out there, and then we take a systematic withdrawal. And when the markets go down 40%, are we prepared to lower our lifestyle by 40%? Most of us would say no. So I think, you know, what my book has done is to try and lay out what we did, well, I've been doing for 24 years, but what we saw worked so marvelously in 2008 and say, you know what, if you will rethink how you place your money, you stand a chance of not running out. And I think that's people's biggest worry these days.
Aaron, I think here's the key. I'm on page 87. Noticed I memorized the title. Okay, I'm on page 87. Okay, I'm a talk show host. I do other things. But the point of contention is I'm not I'm not skilled at investment. I'm not a professional. I don't know the language. I don't know the strategies, etc. So the key is, if I sit down and I say, what do I want for the rest of my life? I would rather have you holding my hand, sitting down with me and say, okay, let's talk about this. You say, I want this for the rest of my life. But then what about that? And because of all of your experience, then you get me honed down to take a realistic look at what I want and what is what's true at the end of the at that time that I can actually accomplish. What's going to be manageable? What's going to be acceptable? What can I truly wrap my arms around? You know, how much cash flow will I need with that lifestyle and so on and so forth? The lifestyles, the essential lifestyle, the needs, the rest of it. These are things most people don't think about. It's not that they're not smart enough. They're not skilled, and I think that's where the key is. You need somebody holding you by the hand, looking over your shoulder, and making sure you see what normally you wouldn't have seen in the first place.
Well, sure. You know, I work with a wide variety of people, from business owners who have just sold their business to some CEOs of some major, major companies. And the funny thing is they know how they made their money. They know how they built their widgets. But this is just an area, you know, that they haven't, they're not used to dealing with. And it's really quite amazing. We all take it for granted that, well, if they, you know, CEO, if they're a CEO of a company or they've built their own business, surely they know how to manage their personal wealth and their personal finances. But that isn't always the case. And so I do think it's important to have some kind of a structure or a format that they can go by. And what it does is it really empowers them to say, okay, here's a checklist. You know, a lot of people operate off of a checklist, or they could, or they would if they could. And so my book tries to provide a checklist, and then they can go to my website and they can download different tools like the House of Security. What would most people consider a need? What would most people consider a want in all of that? So I think the checklist is very important. More than anything, Michael, what I wanted to do, I wanted to make sure, one, to restore confidence in people, because this is not rocket science, okay? It's just really not.
Sure.
But I wanted to give people, I always try and say, I like to work with informed decision makers. And I wanted people to quit blindly taking advice and go, okay, I hope that works out. I wanted them to be able to go to their advisors and challenge the advice that they were being given. And if it's good and it's sound and it makes sense and it holds up to some criteria, then great. Take the advice. But, you know, once upon a time, I took some really bad advice, and somebody lost all of my money for me. And I vowed I would never blindly take anybody's advice again. And so now is my time to give back and show people, you know, what works and what doesn't work in a real-life scenario. And, you know, I would say 2008, the worst, you know, financial crisis that we've had since the Great Depression. If it worked then, I think it's, you know, it may work in some of the other volatile times that they're probably coming, you know, in the near future.
Sure. And even if it's volatile, if for some reason and the why of it, who knows, and if you look back through history, are the financial condition of this country, the world actually, it's cyclical. There's a history of it. It has its ups, it has its downs, and people like yourself have learned to read those ups and downs and to know where the pitfalls are. And I think that's really where the key is, that, you know, there's an old adage that basically says it's not what you don't know, it's what you don't know.
And, yeah.
And we all can't know everything.
No. No, you can't know anything, but I do think that you need a strategy. I think that we're going to see, I personally believe that the financial markets are going to be flat or down over the next 10 to 15 years.
Yeah.
And it'll be up, down, up, down, up, down. And I believe Wall Street wants us to believe that, you know what, recovery is just around the corner. And it almost feels like Jaws, where, you know, people announce, okay, it's safe to get back in the water. And as people tiptoe back into the water, I just think we live in a different economy now. And you know, the economy and what, you know, I have a 28-year-old son. And what I would advise him, I said, honey, I think this market is going to be super volatile, flat or down. And for young people, the next 10 or 15 years, I think, could be wonderful, a wonderful chance to accumulate wealth. And that's if they associate accumulating wealth with buying shares in good companies. And so the strategy that that younger people, anybody, you know, 10 or 15 years away from retirement is buy into the weakness and don't give up. I do believe in the resiliency of the American spirit. And 10 or 15 years from now, after we've dug ourselves out of this $15 trillion in debt, and we have 83 million people coming behind us in the next generation, you know, I believe we'll, you know, the markets will return to some sense of normalcy. But for people that are really close to retirement, or they're already retired and they're taking money out of their accounts every single month, they're really, 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 in my opinion, they're at risk. If they don't change the way they think, they're at risk of running out of money in that time period. They're not going to have enough time, you know, to have this market recover.
Yeah, but Aaron, you have to have, and I'm agreeing with you, by the way, but you have to have something to think. There's got to be something there when you shift your thinking into another area, another avenue. You've got to know where to go with it.
Right, and that's the reason I wrote the book. And it pretty much, if you're on page 87, you're about halfway through. Keep reading.
It's called speed reading.
Good.
Yeah, but realistically, you know, as we're talking and I'm glancing through it, what goes on is I'm seeing more and more and more of here, and I'll use that word again. I'll use it 5,000 times. Here is the strategy. That's
right.
Life in and of itself, Aaron, is a process. You want to build a chair, you start out with the legs, you got the seat, you got the back. And investing is also a process, and knowing where to put that money, what's going to be stable, what's going to be iffy, and there's that combination of both, obviously.
That's correct. And so, in the book, we try and say, you know, the other thing you want to do is you want to avoid major mistakes. And the last chapter of the book talks about other risks that could ruin your day. And those are 22 items that people tend not to think about. In fact, I had one reviewer say, if for no other reason, buy the book just for the last chapter, because she's got in there things that most people don't think about. And, you know, you don't want to be going along and actually doing quite well, and then you have some, you know, some catastrophe happen that you hadn't planned for. So, you know, I don't like to be Debbie Downer, but I do live in the land of worst-case scenario. And I think that, you know, by not addressing some of these risk issues that are out there in terms of your personal finance leaves you pretty vulnerable. So, you know, I totally encourage, sometimes I tell people, read the last chapter first and then start over, you know. So, because you do want to take those risks that are out there that are sort of lurking in the underworld, you want to take those off the table.
Yeah. Yeah, and some risk obviously is okay. But it's that, I'm going to go back to emotions again. It's that quick shot of dopamine that makes you feel good, and you say, oh, I can get rich overnight, and you do it and don't think about it. And then overnight comes, and you've not only lost your money, but you owe a bunch of money. So it's realistic.
Well, you're right. And there's certain risks that we cannot avoid. The risk to our health, the biggest risk that's out there that we have very little control over is the risk to our health. So, you know, you eat well, you exercise, you do those things. But, you know, unfortunately, that's one that we have the least amount of control over. And it's, you know, because with a risk, there's only two things that you can do. You can transfer risk through some means, or you have to just assume the risk and just pray those things don't happen to you. So, but I do think, you know, at least transferring or addressing the risks that, you know, that you can transfer are a wise first step to do.
No, and by the way, I spent, now this is our secret. You won't tell anybody, right?
If I tell
you
this, I won't.
Oh, thank you. I feel better now. I spent 11 years of my life, and as eclectic as it is, as a tax practitioner. And I watched people, and this is years ago, and I watched people who, you know, who came in to do their taxes, big trouble. Why? They were investing over the internet and had no idea what they were doing. Yeah, absolutely. Because it was the get rich quick, you know, one day I'm going to make $1 million and this is going to happen. And that's what, and then by the time they're done, they are in more trouble than they were when they started. And there's nothing you can say because it's already done. They've lost it. And there goes their savings.
Wow.
Oh, and how's this? And on top of that, they had to pay taxes on it.
Right. Yeah, that's a really bad one.
No, that's scary stuff. Oh, you won't tell anybody about this. This is our secret.
No, I promise I won't. You know, that's pretty wild. So
I feel better. All right.
Yeah, but that does happen. And so, you know, to the greatest extent possible, I'm so I'm such an ardent believer in planning. And, you know, people say, well, when should you start planning? Well, now. How's today? You know, and I had my father died when I was 11, and there's very little I remember about him, but there's, you know, things that my mother would tell me over the years. And one thing that he was famous for saying is, you know, the next 10 years, they're going to go by.
Yeah.
The question is, what will you have to show for it? And so I try and get people to think about that. And I always assume that people are planners like I am, because I plan everything. I plan my vacations. In fact, one time I said to my husband, you know, I feel like I spend more of my life planning my life than living my life. And so so I'm probably the extreme, and I review my financial plans all the time. But there's so many people that they spend more time planning their summer vacations than they do their retirement. And the way I think about retirement is I really like to call it more like financial independence. And that's the point at which, you know, our money is supposed to be, or let's put it this way, our work and our time and our effort and everything that we do, you know, for the 40 years of our working lives, they're supposed to be the benefactors that allow us to live the life that we want to live. And so, you know, my goal and my dream, there's 77 million baby boomers out there that if they don't change the way they think about their money and about investing, and if they don't press restart and start over again, they're going to be at risk in this next decade.
Well, absolutely. There's no question about it. And I think really when it comes down to it, it's a lot of it is listen to people like yourself and don't turn the news on.
Well, I don't know about that. I turn the news on a lot, so.
Yeah, but you have a handle on it. There are too many people that are run by fear. And if you listen to these myriad of messages, these media messages that are so confusing, that's what gets people frightened, and they take these chances that they shouldn't be taking. It's that, you know, if you don't do this, this is what's going to happen to you, and the next thing you know, you do it, and you've lost everything that you have.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And, you know, as much as I've been on some of the talk TV shows, I really do realize that so much of the advice that is given is really directed toward traders, professional traders. And, you know, my clients and most people that I know, my friends, they're not traders. They're good, hardworking people that want to know that if they work hard and save diligently, that they can build a better life for themselves or their children. And for them to even listen to some of this trading advice, I think I was listening earlier and you had another guest and they were talking about high-frequency trading. And I thought, you know, this is a different ball game. Even, you know, with the Internet and with computers, these high-frequency traders it's very difficult to level the playing field anymore because you're dealing with professionals, and there's only a handful of them that are completely moving the market. So if you think you can play in that arena, more power to you. But most of my clients, you know, they like the occasional adrenaline rush that comes with, you know, rolling the dice at a craps table, and they would do that with their play money, but they certainly don't want to do that with their, you know, their mortgage money or their health insurance money.
But the problem is that they do. And at the time, they're not realizing it. Most of us think right now, pain, pleasure, right now. What is it that's going to make you feel good right now? And you're not projecting out that month, that 2 months, 3 months, whatever the case may be. Aaron, we're starting to run out of time. Do you have a website that we can find you at, buy the book, and get more information?
Yes, my website is www.thebigretirementrisk.com. Or you can order my book, The Big Retirement Risk, Running Out of Money Before You Run Out of Time. You can order it on Amazon, or it's available at Barnes & Noble or any of the major bookstores.
Wonderful. And by the way, thank you so much. Now, by the way, do you have any downloads, any?
Yes, we have a lot of free downloads on the website. We have the House of Security. We have a risk analysis. It's not a risk tolerance questionnaire. I'm kind of funny that way. I know what people's risk tolerance is. It's very, very high when the markets are going up, and it's zero when the markets are going down. So there's no need for a risk tolerance questionnaire. But we do have a risk assessment in terms of what kind of insurances do you have and what kind of risks are you exposed to. We have several downloads on our website. It's thebigretirementrisk.com.
Wonderful. Aaron, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Take care. Good night.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call, and the only heart I own for you and you alone. Well, that's all. Well, that's all.
I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. That's all. That's all. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Every night I hope and pray a dream lover will come my way. A girl to hold in my arms and know the magic of her charms. Because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone. Dream lover, where are you? With a love oh so true, and a hand that I can hold to feel you near as I grow old.
Because I want
a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone. Someday, I don't know how, I hope that she'll hear my plea. Some way, I don't know how, she'll bring her love to me. Dream lover, until then, I'll go to sleep and dream again.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Kevin Gray with us. He's the author of The Decline of Black Politics from Malcolm X to Barack Obama. And as a matter of fact, there's something that we should take a look at that Kevin says we really haven't seen. Kevin, hi. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. When you say the decline of black politics, define that and then we'll move forward.
Well, the black politics. You want me to define black politics?
Yeah, please.
Well, you know, I equate black politics to progressive politics, so let's start there.
Okay.
And black politics throughout history have dealt with fighting for equal protection, due process, equal opportunity and treatment, economic rights. And it's from that framework that you look at the Voting Rights Act, the Civil Rights Act, the Great Society programs of Lyndon Johnson, and of course the movement toward electing more black elected officials from the death of Dr. King till now. When Dr. King was alive, there were about 100 black elected officials. Now there are over 10,000. And of course, black politics means what do you do with that increase in black elected officials? Does it mean a structural change in the way blacks and other minorities are living in terms of those bedrock rights of equal protection, due process, and then the wealth disparity that due mostly to slavery and Jim Crowism and state-sponsored discrimination?
Okay, well, okay, let's go back to
that's a long answer, isn't it?
No, it's a good answer, though,
okay.
But it lays the base of where we're going to go, Kevin. Okay, so when we really take a look at it, when we're talking about the elected black elected officials, both sides, Republican and Democrat, so it's not necessarily a political stance on either side that we are dealing with. You're talking about an intrinsic and inherent problem that seems to be pervasive within the country. The other side of that also is this. There's a tremendous amount of high school dropouts today. Those black and white, Hispanic, doesn't really matter. They drop out of school, they can't get a job, so the problems start. There's a tremendous amount of poverty that is going on. But at the same time, the businesses today, if they say they're not going to hire somebody because of a race, of an ethnicity, a gender, or something, there are problems. So there are laws against this now that are being put in place, and there are people getting sued, and we've got a position where now we have to define what an American is and what we truly are and what we stand for. I think it's all falling apart right now, and we don't have a common definition to move forward. So whether it's the decline of black politics, it's also the decline of white politics, Hispanic politics, and it's all going down the drain right now unless we do something about it.
Well, it's always been a class issue, but in the history of the country, as narrowly as I define it within the community that I live in and operate in, I define it as black politics. But as I said, it's all about the protection of equal rights, equal opportunity, and equal treatment for the individual. As we look at it from the perspective of the direction that the country is moving in, what is sustainable? What's sustainable to keep the country going another 200 years? What's sustainable as it relates to economics, and what kinds of social structures that you have to build to maintain a society? What's old is new. The educational system was predicated, according to Benjamin Franklin, on the idea of mobility, not nobility. So you can look at the attack on equal opportunity in education through perhaps the voucher system or charter schools, because we're talking about picking the best kids out of a district or school or neighborhood and moving them to some sort of elite educational system, or we're talking about an educational system that is dependent upon the marketplace and the vagaries of the marketplace.
Let me hold you up, and you're right. It has to do with the marketplace, but these voucher systems, it's not just the elite. I want to take you all the way back to the schools today. The schools today, they're supposed to be teaching in the basic schools how to read, how to write, how to do mathematics, you know, the basic principles. 100 years ago, when I was in high school, they had auto shop, they had all of those courses that you could get your arms wrapped around if you weren't going to go on for higher education. It taught people how to get out right after high school, get a job, and to go to work. Yes, there is no question about it. I remember growing up in the 50s and 60s. I was in I was brought up in Los Angeles. Now, prejudice was there. There's no question. I was around when the Watts riots were there. Matter of fact, some of my family's family were killed in those riots, and I was working with guys that lived right in the middle of South Central Watts at the time. So I got that. I finally understood what prejudice was. In 1960, I was in the Marine Corps, and a lot of the guys were from Texas that I went through boot camp with. And I'll remember this for as long as I live, because I really truly understood how prejudice worked and how people felt about it. We came out from chow, we're standing in formation, and I smoked in those days, we're having a cigarette, and a guy that I buddied up with, which will be nameless here, I buddied up with him, I'm standing there, and we're having a cigarette, he's not talking. I said, what's the matter? He's not talking. I said, what's wrong? And he finally looked at me, and he said, if my daddy knew that I had lunch with an N, that he'd kill me. And that was the first time, Kevin, that I ever got exposed to that kind of experience or a feeling about how much hate there was, and there didn't have to be any. Because my feeling about it is this, if you were, and I thank God I was never in combat, but if you're in a combat situation, it doesn't matter what color, what gender, whatever it is, who's behind your back taking care of you, that's what we should have in this country today. But I saw it, I was exposed to it, not that I'll ever understand it, but I did see it.
Well, I grew up in the segregated South in the 60s, and my sister and I desegregated the schools in our school district in the 60s. And of course, my father was a career Navy person. I was in the military. And so I do understand that. But that gets back to where it is that we're going as a society and what we spend our money on and what we believe is important. When we were coming up, even with the tension and the struggle, and a lot of us didn't necessarily want to desegregate into the white schools because that's down in the South, that's how that went. It wasn't like white kids came into a black situation. Black kids went into a white situation. But we understood, although we didn't want to, because a lot of us were happy in the safe harbor of the black school system in a segregated mean South in the 60s with teachers that lived in the neighborhood and knew our names and knew our parents. And we knew they cared for us. They weren't in education as just simply a career. Back then you aspired, if you were going to school, a black, little black kid in school, you aspired to be an educator.
Sure.
And so it was just a different mindset. But still and all, I just wrote an editorial for my hometown newspaper about with the principal of the all-black high school that I went to just died at 98, and he started teaching in 1939. And he taught generations of black kids. But he knew intuitively, because he was the person, one of the people with my parents, that made the call that me and my sister would go to the all-white elementary school. They knew that they were preparing kids, regardless of whether or not that school that they were principals and teachers in was a safe harbor. They knew that they were preparing kids for the next move into an integrated America. And to some extent, some of them wouldn't be able to make that transition with us. But they, even for the personal loss as it relates to their professional careers, because a lot of those black principals didn't go over to be principals at predominantly white schools, that the idea was to create a more diverse society. And so now, and then you look at the struggles in the 60s and 70s on the Vietnam War and sure. the message that Dr. King laid out in the Riverside speech and the opposition to the Vietnam War as it related to the money that went to war as opposed to what went to feed the hungry and clothe the naked and educate our kids. We're still facing that right now. We're talking about a school system at the bottom that's failing and the school system as it relates to going to college or university that can put you in debt the rest of your life. We're willing to spend as a country that's been at war every 20 years since its existence. And in Afghanistan, we still have contractors in Iraq. And now we're talking about going to war with Iran. We're willing to spend $1 million per troop per year for kids who are coming back to this country, and we're reading every day in the newspaper in California about the young soldier, ex-soldier that killed the homeless people, or the young soldier who killed the park ranger, or the young soldier who shot the people at the New Year's Eve party, the high rate of military suicides. We're willing to spend money to maintain 700 bases around the world, but we're not willing to spend money to educate kids. And so we've got to, as a nation, because you're right in your premise at the beginning of this conversation, for me it really isn't about black politics. That's a way to get people into the conversation. It's about the kind of politics that are sustainable for our survival. What are humane politics? How do we move from being a warlike culture in society to one that fosters peace around the world and regain some measure of moral authority with the world?
Okay, Kevin, I have to, in what I do, and I've been doing this for right around 29 years now, okay? And so I have to kind of keep my fingers on the pulse of what's going on. There's some more inherent problems than that. Let's go back to the schools. Let's go back to the high schools. Let's go back to the junior high schools. Let's go to the dropout. Detroit, you're looking at 55% dropout rate, yada, yada, and the list goes on. 20-30% dropout across the country. When they get out, the jobless numbers are skyrocketing. Why? Let's pull the businesses back in, the manufacturing from China, from Japan, from India. Let's start manufacturing. Let's start doing what we used to do where there will be jobs. Let the administration allow that pipeline coming in from Canada because there's jobs like we wouldn't believe that are there. First thing, let's put them to work. The second problem we have, and I run into this constantly, my niece's daughter, which would be my second, it was my niece's niece. She's my niece. She's my family. I mean, this kid comes to my house. She's my family. She's black. All right. Now, here's the problem. She went to, in the South, she was going to an all-black school, and she came home, and she was uncomfortable because her mom and dad, her birth father was divorced from my niece, and she remarried again, so they're both white. She's very uncomfortable because her parents are white, and she doesn't want to let the kids that she runs around with know because they're looking down at her, yada, yada. Now, this is my family. I have an African-American kid in my family. She's about 15 years old now. My family. Mess with her, you mess with me. This is my family. Okay, that said, I walk into a store in a predominantly black neighborhood. Kevin, half the time I feel like somebody's going to come out and get me because the nasty looks and the rest of it and whatever. That's where it's got to stop.
Now, let's be realistic about let me make the point now, because when you go back and look at crime rates between blacks and whites, well, it's low. And you're more likely to be attacked by someone you know. It's not necessarily a condition of race that you might feel
addressed. I'm not talking crime. I'm talking about some of the young women, some of the young men. They don't even know me, and they look at me like they look down.
I'm 54. That might be a condition of us getting old now. Yeah, come on now, because kids of any color scare old people, kids. Make old people feel uncomfortable. Now that's the reality of that.
Okay, I wouldn't attribute it
to anything other than that. And kids are always flexing their muscle and trying to show their dominance over older people and trying to shock or intimidate older people. That's what young people do, black and white. But now, as it relates to education, even those who don't get their high school education, who might have dropped out, you know, that doesn't mean that that they can't learn or catch up at some other point in their life. The thing that we have to do as a society is figure out a different way to live. Maybe, you know, we're never going to compete with cheap labor abroad. No, nobody in this country is going to want to work for $2 and $3 an hour. That's not going to happen. We ought to be talking about a livable wage in this country, which is what Dr. King talked about right before he died. Not just a minimum wage, but a minimum wage. And maybe we ought to learn to live differently, finding a different source of energy instead of running a pipeline all the way across the country, because I don't know how many jobs it's going to create. I don't know if I agree with you on that. And maybe looking at solar power and maybe not even be so much, not being so much of a consumption nation where we are just consuming and consuming for whatever reason, like a crackhead on crack. And the idea that we shop and shop and shop so that we can have luxury or the facsimile of luxury. We might have to learn to live differently. When you and I came up, a father, one person could work in a household, and that would be enough. Now, two people have to work in a household, just sometimes to maintain the basics, utilities, to pay your mortgages, to pay your insurances, all the various kinds of insurance, and people complain about what it is that the poor don't do. The poor pay more because of bad credit. They pay higher interest. It's harder for them to get a job because jobs might be based on credit ratings. So, you know, we have to learn to live differently.
All right, Kevin, let me hold you up. We're running out of time, but I'm going to throw a little offer out at you, okay?
Okay.
Let's do a segment once a week. We're going to do a he said, he said, and let's get right down to the bottom of all this stuff, bring it to the forefront and roll with it. Because, you know, if you're willing to, quote unquote, take off the gloves, and I mean respectfully, you hear what I'm saying, and let's get the issues out and work with it. I'm willing to do that if you are.
Well, let me give it some thought, because, you know, it is,
once a month.
It is tough. I am in South Carolina. I'm an organizer.
Yeah.
And you know, I do a weekly radio show on Sirius Radio with Dave Marsh, which is pretty, you know, right. Gloves off. It's uncensored radio. But sure. But I will give it some thought. I may well do that with you.
Yeah, and because realistically, when, you know, it's another audience, and when it really comes down to it, it's putting it out on a practical basis. That's what I'm looking at.
Yeah.
Okay, is there a website we can find you at, buy the book?
You can go to the New Liberator at WordPress.org, or, you know, you can always just Google Kevin Alexander Gray, and most of my articles, some of that I run through the Progressive, through Counterpunch, a couple with The Nation, will always come up. The other book work and the pieces I have in books. I think I have some essays coming out in Alexander and Jeffrey St. Clair's new book, Hopeless, that's coming out in the spring. So, I'm very easy. My stuff is very easy to find online.
Wonderful. And by the way, thanks for being on with us tonight.
Well, thank you.
Okay. Hey, take care and go get them.
Gotcha.
Okay. Good night.
Off comes the clown's disguise. The curtain's fallen. The music softly dies.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser.
I'm Radio
Susie. As you're filing out
to the right,
as they say in this biz,
and that, my friends, is a wrap.
That's all there is. There isn't any more.